I'm extremely excited to announce a brand new sponsor for the Behind the Shield podcast, and that is Rescue One CBD. For any of you who have listened to this podcast for the last 8 years, you would have heard my own personal journey from using prescription pills after a knee surgery to finding CBD and having incredible success with that. Now, I'm sure everyone listening is fully aware that we have an epidemic when it comes to the use of nicotine pouches, dip, and other products. Now, to combat this, John from Rescue One has developed a nicotine-free pouch called the Rip Pouch. It's the first and only pouch that contains CBG, nootropics, and B vitamins for both energy and mental clarity. And as with all of their products, is tested to ensure it is 0.000% THC free. So completely trusted for anyone in uniform. And they always send a drug test with their products just to give you guys peace of mind. Now, the pre-sale for this incredible product has just begun and goes on till October 1st. So if you go to rescue1cbd.com, you can register for the pre-sale and make sure it ships the moment it is available. Now, on top of all that, Rescue One is offering you, the listener of the Behind the Shield podcast, 15% off your order if you use the code BTS, as in Behind the Shield. And you can find all of their products, you can find all of the testing and understand why this truly is a product that you can trust by going to rescue1cbd.com. And you can listen to my conversation with John on episode 1011 of the Behind the Shield podcast. This episode is brought to you by Thorne, and I have some incredible news for any of you that are in the military, first responder, or medical professions. In an effort to give back, Thorne is now offering you an ongoing 25% off each and every one of your purchases of their incredible nutritional solutions. Now, Thorne is the official supplement of CrossFit, the UFC, the Mayo Clinic, the Human Performance Project, and multiple special operations organizations. I myself have used them for several years, and that is why I brought them on as a sponsor. Some of my favorite products they have are their Multivitamin Elite, their Whey Protein, the Super EPA, and then most recently, Cinequil. As a firefighter, a stuntman, and a martial artist, I've had my share of brain trauma and sleep deprivation, and Cinequil is their latest brain health supplement. Now, to qualify for the 35% off, go to thorne.com, thorne.com. Click on sign in and then create a new account. You will see the opportunity to register as a first responder or member of military. When you click on that, it will take you through verification with GovX. You'll simply choose a profession, provide one piece of documentation, and then you are verified for life. From that point onwards, you will continue to receive 35% off through Thorne. Now, for those of you who don't qualify, there is still the 10% off using the code BTS10, Behind the Shield 10, for a one-time purchase. Now, to learn more about Thorne, go to episode 323 of the Behind the Shield podcast with Joel Totoro and Wes Barnett. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome back onto the show world-renowned holistic farmer, author and speaker, Joel Salatin. Now, the last time Joel and I spoke was during the COVID pandemic. So I wanted to circle around again, especially after the conversation of making America healthy again, and revisit so many of the areas that were completely disregarded after that event. So we discuss a host of topics, from bolstering local farming, regenerative agriculture, food in our schools, exercise, community, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 1,100 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I welcome back onto the show, Joel Salatin. Enjoy. Well, Joel, I want to start by saying, firstly, thank you for coming back for the third time. Our first conversation, you were one of my very first guests, which I'm honored. That was like 9 years ago now, pretty much. Second time, you were one of the first people I reached out to during COVID, realizing that the ownership and the ability for people to start working on their own health was not being discussed in August 2020 when we last sat down. So, there's such a, an interesting kind of lineage as far as our conversations. So firstly, just kind of rounding back to the beginning of this intro, welcome back to the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thank you. It's a delight to be with you.
So jumping straight in, the last time we spoke, August 2020, I could see the writing on the wall as far as the autonomy being taken from people, the impact of their own underlying health during that virus being woefully under-discussed, and then, the bottlenecks and some of the things that we saw as far as food delivery, slaughterhouses, all those kind of areas. So before we kind of dive into some of the modern day things, I'm going to give you the microphone. What have been the takeaways? Because as we rounded off the end of the pandemic, I feel that there was a lot of sweeping under the rug rather than going, okay, what did we do well? What didn't we do well? What can we learn from this?
Oh, wow. That's a broad question. I guess for me, the number one takeaway, and I'm certainly not alone in this, is we have an unprecedented in modern times, an unprecedented disrespect might be too strong a word, but a questioning of venerable institutions, especially government institutions, but even doctors. I mean, the latest surveys show that 67% of people don't even trust their own doctors. That's one of the most, venerable, trust relationships there is. I mean, next to marriage and things. And so for people to, way over half the people to actually admit that they're questioning their doctor is a powerful thing. And so what that does, it's not just in the health field. It permeates everything then. Do you trust any official government narrative? And when you have a basic societal breakdown in trust of leadership, that we're not getting a straight answer. We're not getting, we don't trust the economic reports. We don't trust the labor reports. We don't trust, the narrative of what's going on in a foreign country. We're getting ready to, send military there or aid there or break ties or make treaties or, all of these societal decisions. Are under this cloud of duplicity within the culture, and that can be seen as negative. It can also be a catalyst for major change. And so obviously here we're seeing major changes with MAHA, with Trump's election, with RFK Jr. coming in, and literally what I call a homestead tsunami. We are just seeing, a proliferation of an exodus back to the land, home gardening, backyard chickens, home cooking, sourdough starter and, sprouts on the windowsill and these sorts of things. And so, and the entire alternative health community, chiropractic, acupuncture, herbology, essential oils, everything that's considered quackery. And so, while it's a societal upheaval to have that kind of spasm occur. We also know that it is the disturbance that facilitates the next innovation, whatever innovation is. You don't have innovation without disturbance, and so innovation becomes a catalyst for new things.
What's been interesting, you know, normally the conversation will be whatever the administration is now. They'll be like, oh, well, because if they did it the way that my, you know, Democratic or Republican Party did it, then everything would be fine. And I think that I'm seeing now COVID spanned both sides. The obesity crisis has spanned, you know, numerous, you know, decades of both sides. Is I think that people are starting to see the organizations and the humans that actually are doing, you know, are serving, are selfless servants and have the best interests of the nation in mind. We all are seeing who they are, and then we're seeing conversely the ones that aren't. And whether it's, you know, the defund the police or the vaccines or, you know, whatever, you can insert whatever it is, the things that people were told versus the actual impact and the reality are two different things. And I'm seeing that the cracks are starting to form in the overall, you know, whether it's government, as you said, whether it's governing bodies. I mean, a good example, the FDA approved OxyContin and refused to approve MDMA-led therapy. You know, we're starting to see now where the roadblocks are. And then I think the backstory, where that money is coming from. Another one, CBD. The fact that CBD is having such resistance, but you can, you know, take all kinds of antidepressants from your doctor.
Yes. Well, what this is doing, I think that the bigger societal evolution in this is that people are beginning to feel autonomous. That there is a huge yearning actually to own myself. To own my own decisions, own myself, and to vet for myself, and that's a good thing, because you know propaganda runs narratives, and if people aren't thinking, then you know they're easily led to other places that may not be very good, and so. So all of this distrust, mistrust, and questioning is, I think, moving us as a culture to a more independent, spirited thinking that maybe I can take care of myself. Maybe I can do more for myself. And of course, the government's bankrupt. I mean, we're now spending $8 billion a day just in interest on the national debt. It's growing, and neither party seems at all interested in handling the national debt, which can only be handled not by raising taxes. They're already as high as they can be, but it's going to be handled by cutting government spending. And so, but that those all become sacred cows, because we now have almost more people on the government teat than we have actually, you know, taking care of themselves and paying into the system. So, you know, when you have that many people dependent on these government programs, it's a serious economic drain on the country, on the culture, and those people vote. So, you know, I don't know where initiatives will go. I mean, if I were making the rules, I would say nobody can vote unless they pay more to the government than they receive. I would make that a new stipulation. Our founders were scared to death of democracy. They called democracy mob rule. And essentially democracy says, you know, whatever the majority says goes, and there's no protection for the minority. Whereas a republic is a representative type of option. So, you know, I would like to see, you know, originally it was you had to own land in order to vote, but we're not an agrarian society anymore. So I would move that to, you know, you should pay taxes in order to vote. If you're not paying taxes, then, you know, you don't get to vote. That's the new stakeholder. That's the new country stakeholder benchmark. And so, you know, I would be happy to see something like that. But of course, I would, you know, as a libertarian, I mean, I would like to see 90% of whatever the government does just eliminated, and let the market, let people, let individuals, let localities and states, you know, take over what they want and let go what they want. I mean, another interesting one would be to have people, when you do pay taxes, be able to designate your taxes. So my taxes go to, you know, if you like the military, you can designate it to the military. If you like education, it can go to education. If you like, you know, Medicaid, it can go to, you know, Department of Health and Human Services. But, you know, maybe we couldn't, it'd be cumbersome to do it in every little department, but certainly at a cabinet level. And that way you truly have people funding or defunding what they don't want. I mean, you know, voting with their tax dollars and saying, I want this department, I don't want this department. Wouldn't that be an exciting thing? And then the departments would have to vie for taxpayer dollars, like the grocery store has to vie for your grocery dollars. That would put some accountability in the system. So, you know, there's a lot of interesting ways to go, but I'll tell you, the entrenched power, you know, the status quo, the entrenched power brokers will not go gently into the night. You know, they're kicking and screaming on everything. I mean, even the notion that we shouldn't pay for Coca-Cola in nutrition programs. I mean, the pushback on that is severe.
What I've said as far as reflecting on COVID is, you know, we talk about autonomy. I think autonomy was taken away. And if you could write down, how could you ensure that people are most vulnerable for this virus as it sweeps through the nation? It's exactly what they did. Well, don't let them see family or friends. Don't let them see daylight. Allow them to get fast food delivered to their home and alcohol if they want it. And then they can binge watch Netflix. So, you know, we couldn't have done it worse. And what I've said is, if it really was about the health, which, you know, this is what was touted to us, then over the last few years, we would have seen PE programs restored in schools, you know, arts and sports bolstered, local organic farms subsidized, you know, pedestrianization of some downtowns, you know, everything that would get people eating cleaner food, moving better. I mean, putting real food in schools, especially. And we didn't see any of that. We saw a complete resistance. So, you know, please jump in.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you imagine, James, if Anthony Fauci had stepped to the microphone one day and said, okay, America, here's the deal. We're going to try an experiment. We're going to do an experiment for 1 month. 1 month. Everybody's, you can do this. Trust me, you can do this. All right. So for 1 month, we're not going to eat any junk food, ultra processed food. We're going to cook from scratch, use all our kitchen gadgetry and stuff. And we're going to use our crock pots, Instapots, you know, blenders and slicers and dicers and ice cream makers and bread makers. And we're going to cook from scratch for a month. Number two, we're all dehydrated. We're all going to drink half a gallon of water a day. We got to get our bodies hydrated, so they'll function better. Number three, we're not getting enough sleep. So everybody's going to commit to getting 8 hours of sleep a night. If you can get 8.5, that's even better. But at least 8 hours, you're not going to stay up late watching TV. You know, we're going to get 8 hours of sleep a night. Next, we're going to get out in the sun. We're going to get in the sun for 20 minutes a day. Next, we're going to sweat for 20 minutes a day. You can walk, you can jump or jack, you can whatever you want to do, but sweat. Sweat is the number one detoxing. Get your heart pumping, get your lungs moving. You know, let's move. We're going to get 20 minutes of sweat a day. And let's see, what else could we do? I know what we can do. We can make a list of all the people that you hate, all the people that you just despise. Make a list, but write them down on a list and then forgive them. Just forgive them. And we're going to let forgiveness run our lives. You know, can you just imagine if that kind of, you know, language or experiment had been promoted at the pedestals of power, what would have happened? I'm convinced that we would have had, you know, half the issues, and we would have come through it much, much better than we did.
Absolutely. Well, you talk as well about the financial side. It's been interesting from the fire service point of view. We've had a downward spiral, and there's been a recruitment crisis, and they're having to pay overtime because they don't have enough first responders. And so you look downstream at the millions, tens of millions, if you're talking about LA and some of these places, hundreds of millions of dollars wasted every year just on overtime rather than investing in creating a healthy work week, you know, a livable salary for our first responders. And it's that false economy. And you look at, you know, the health of the nation. I mean, billions and billions and billions of dollars wasted because we haven't invested in the health of our people. I think a good, you know, comparison is the NHS. When I was young, sadly, it's been butchered now, but the whole premise was we take care of our, you know, whoever needs it at the time in the UK, whether it's people with, you know, that are pregnant and having young children, whether it's the elderly, whether it's someone fighting cancer. But that only works if you forge health in the rest of the country so they're not draining your tax. Now, here we have a profit-based healthcare system or disease management system. And so now we're at the point where we have over 70% of our population are obese or overweight. So even from a financial point of view, there's such a drive to make our nation healthier so we can free up that money to put in education and first responders and, you know, all the other things that we've talked about. But this, I think, is again, spans both sides of the aisle, is we have got fatter and sicker, and there is a dollar amount attached to every single illness in this country.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so curative, that brings up the economics of curative care rather than preventive care. Generally, certainly here on the farm, I would much rather spend a few extra dollars keeping my cows and my chickens healthy than trying to combat an illness. You know, if I scrimp on the nutrition or the sanitation or the stress, maybe, you know, I've got them too crowded or whatever. But if I scrimp on that and they all get sick, the curative bill is going to way outrun what would have been a preventive bill, you know, at the front end. And so the question, you know, I think there are two issues here that are really strong. One is, well, how much has current policy incentivized negative behavior or dysfunction? And of course, you know, we subsidize corn, we subsidize soybeans, wheat, sugar cane, cotton and rice. We subsidize these things, and so the price of all these things become extremely low. And then, you know, the government does a food pyramid that puts, you know, Twinkies and Cocoa Puffs on the foundational bottom of the food pyramid. And so you have this one thread or one issue of government involvement, government intervention, whether it's in, you know, health, food eating, farm, what produces on the farm. There are all sorts of fingers on the scale, if you will, that government policy, you know, intervenes in the system. The other part of that then is, or the flip side of that coin is, how do you create a population in which the average person is making a good decision, a good choice? How do you stimulate good choice? I think the answer to that is you have to make people responsible for the outcome of their choice. You can't stimulate discernible or discerning choice and then have a helicopter safety net that says, well, whatever you choose, we'll, you know, we'll fix it. We'll take care of it. It's all going to be okay. And you can't have those two. And so, at the risk of sounding, you know, harsh or cruel or uncaring, for me, the way to develop responsible decision-making is to exercise decision-making by having people have to, you know, live with the outcome of their decisions. All right, you want to drink 3 Cokes a day and get diabetes? Well, have at it, you know. And when you get diabetes, there won't be a government program to help you. You know, you're going to have to, and, you know, as soon as that happens, people start making better decisions. I mean, think about children. I mean, this is a, I don't know if you've got children. We've raised a couple of children. You'll never have a responsible teenager if you don't let a toddler make some decisions and live with the consequences. That ball bounced back and hit you in the head. Yeah. I mean, okay. So balls do that, you know, and you can learn those kind of things. But if you never give a kid a ball to risk bouncing it and hit him in the head, he's never going to know that a ball can bounce, hit him in the head. And so, I mean, that's a very, you know, maybe a silly comparison, but I think that's how basic this is. You cannot engender exercise decision-making muscles in a society when you don't allow people or don't put the onus on people to live with their decisions. And I think that those are two related but very different things. What should the government intervene on, or the perverse incentives that the government seems to place in a marketplace? It's perverse. But then the second part is the incorrect trust that people place in this safety net. And it's very much, as we've seen it now, it's a very misplaced trust. If you trust the government to tell you what to eat and what medications to take and how to live, you're not going to be a healthy person.
No, especially again, when you see some of these representatives are supposed to be in charge of health and they didn't even own their own. Like, that's a big red flag, right? You know?
That's right.
Well, one of the things that I try and be very fair about, and again, this is bringing it out so that we can address this. I grew up on a farm in England. My dad was a veterinary surgeon. You know, we ate our own meat. We had orchards. We had vegetable gardens. You know, it was 60 acres that I got to play on as a kid. So my exposure to movement, to suffering, you know, to the circle of life, to, you know, what vegetables look like, you know, what, you know, creating a whole food meal looks like, was very different than a young boy that grew up in, you know, the Bronx, who only had a, you know, basketball that court that had gangs on it, and then a bodega to learn about their food. So yeah, obviously, you know, one of the best places that we can take that place then and help those kids that just don't have that exposure to, you know, the most holistic of upbringings is school. But you look at the food that's served in schools, that obviously the dismantling of recess and PE and all these other things where they're outside and playing as well, but also, you know, soda machines in schools and the processed food that comes in on a giant shiny Cisco truck. These children aren't being exposed to nutrition and all the positive things in that system either. So if you were a king for a day, we had a pandemic, you know, it got everyone's attention. It was completely disregarded. We jump in a time machine, we go back to 2020. What are the changes that we should be making in our schools so we can create this environment for good decisions in the first place?
Well, just to be perfectly transparent, I don't think education is the government's responsibility. So I wouldn't even have a public school. Mm-hmm. But if we let that lie, that's, you know, too weird for the average person. So if we let that lie, and say, well, what should we do with school lunches? Well, I think the first thing would be to increase the daily allotment. And of course, the problem is the school lunches go off of the nutrition program, the official FDA, you know, USDA nutrition program, which is anti-meat, anti-good food, and the schools don't even cook anything anymore. And so there have been numerous school districts who have gone to scratch cooking here, and I've run into some of them, and they actually make it work. I mean, I ran into one in Florida, for example, where they used grass-finished beef in the school lunch program. And what they did, they sold the top end of the animal to patrons, to parents, and then that left enough of the ground beef in the school lunch program. They just used the ground beef because they didn't serve ribeye steaks for the kids in school. It'd be nice if they did, but they were happy to have the ground beef. All right, and this gave the bottom end of the cow then it was able to come in under the per plate cost. The quickest way to move it forward is number one, to demand scratch cooking again. I mean, when I was in school, I went through public school, and my wife Teresa and I were talking about the other day when we were in school. I mean, when I started my chickens when I was 12, 13, 14 years old, I served two public schools in our area right here with all their eggs, and I would go weekly and take eggs in, I mean, shell eggs to the school, the cafeteria. Well, if you're using shell eggs, you're cooking from scratch something, you know, you are making something from scratch. And, I mean, they had bags of potatoes. They would peel potatoes and make, you know, mashed potatoes. They made bread. I mean, school lunches might not have been, you know, five-star gourmet Michelin rated, but they actually cooked in-house. And if you, but what's happened is the school lunch program has been taken over by Coca-Cola and Cisco and these, you know, Marriott food services and these kind of outfits. And it's become essentially a dumping ground for sell-by stuff. The same thing is true in prisoner lunches. I was picked up at the airport by a guy who was an administrator at a prison down in Alabama. And I asked him what the per plate cost was for prisoners' food. And it was 60 cents a plate. I said, how can you possibly create a meal for 60 cents? This is ingredients, not labor, just ingredient cost. And he said, well, he said, we get all the stuff that the sell by date goes out of and all this. And we're basically a salvage operation for Tyson and Del Monte and whatever, if they have a bunch of damaged, green beans in a can or whatever, you know, we get that kind of stuff. And, so the fact is that the public meal things, whether it's prisons or schools, interesting. There's a lot of similarity between those two things, but that's another talk for another day. Those we don't have in our culture. We don't have an understanding of value there. I mean, let's take the Iraq War. When we were in the Iraq War, we spent every day in the Iraq War looking for weapons of mass destruction, which didn't exist. We spent as much per day in the Iraq War, enough to double the plate cost of every public school meal in the United States for a whole year. That's how much we spent per day. So, you know, when you start looking at the figures, you realize there is no problem on earth that isn't being fixed because there's a lack of money. It's a difference of allocation. And so, and this is of course what RFK Jr. is saying. I mean, I was just in DC a couple of days ago at a kind of a MAHA consortium. And it was interesting. They were saying that for one trillion dollars, now that's a lot of money, $1 trillion, that if that were moved from government health care to the prisons and the school lunch programs, it would trade itself off. In other words, the health consequences would more than the health consequences, or the lack of needing medical care, would pay the extra meal costs of getting actual food in the school lunch program. So there's a lot of ways to skin this cat, whether you just mandate it, whether you make a trade-off, whether you cut the budget for one thing. I mean, goodness, right now the U.S. subsidies for corn, soybean meal, and wheat and sugar cane and cotton and rice, those subsidies, I haven't done the figures right very quickly here, but if you took all that money together, those subsidies right there would double, I'm sure, would double the per plate cost of every public school thing. So what we got to do is we got to be willing to sacrifice some sacred cows for the sake of protecting our children, which is exactly what RFK Jr.'s agenda is. And he's being excoriated and crucified daily for actually suggesting some of these things to take on the entrenched, interests.
I would love to get your perspective on what he's trying to do. I was a huge fan before, when he was independent. And from, I've said this on here, there was this big kind of MAHA push pre-election. And then I feel like his part of this, his message really hasn't been disseminated on the national stage. Okay, here's what we're doing. Here's the initiatives. Here's, the obesity crisis. Here's some of the solutions we're proposing, et cetera, et cetera. So you obviously have the kind of lens that's able to kind of storytell, what are the initiatives that he's trying to push forward? And then what, if any, are some of the roadblocks that he's finding at the moment?
Yeah, one initiative for sure. I was just looking for that here. One initiative for sure is to do this kind of health trade-off. And what happens when you start investing in wellness instead of investing in sickness is you start this wonderful domino effect of good things. And so, think about the domino effect of eating nutrient dense or proper food. Well, chances are that's going to patronize farms, a different kind of farm than the industrial ag complex. Fewer chemicals, maybe smaller scale, maybe local, maybe more fresh. But you start doing that. Well, the association between the microbiome and the brain and the bodily function, what we're seeing, these then suddenly kids are more emotionally stable. You start school gardens. I'm a big fan of school gardens, and let kids get out there and, work in the dirt, find earthworms, all sorts of things. I was at one time we had a juvenile home, a kind of a halfway house here in our county for emotionally disturbed kids that were so dysfunctional that they couldn't be in a classroom. So they would go to this it was a boarding situation. They would go there every week and live in this house. Well, the guy that was in charge of the food was a guy like I believe. And he said, I'm going to go scratch. I'm going to go local, blah, blah, blah. Make a long story short, he started buying all of his meat from us and with no hormones, no nothing in it. And he told me that, and he took sugar off the table, no sugar, no candy, no sugar. And he said every week by Friday, those kids were completely normal, settled, look you in the eye. They didn't bounce off the walls. They were fine. They'd go home with their weekend. Parents would fill them up with Coke and candy. They come back Monday bouncing off the walls. He said, we don't have an emotional problem. We've got a food problem. And I'm sure that that story could be repeated 1,000 times around the country. And so this domino effect of when you say, okay, what can we fix? We can't stop every divorce. We can't stop every single parent household. I mean, we know those have an effect too. We can't. What we can do is, what are we buying? Well, we're buying food. So let's start there. Let's start with the food. And then just like chemical agriculture has unintended externalized costs, I think when you put attention on food value and you start dealing with nutritional wellness with kids, you have a domino effect of unintended, unexpected, positive consequences. So now the kids sit there, you know, they can learn, their brains work better. They have better self-esteem, self-worth. And the farmers that are being patronized for this, they become more successful, which then helps the rural economy, which then brings back, a functional economy in some of these, very, very rural areas. And then we maybe have kids that want to, instead of they want to leave the farm because there's no opportunity, they want to stay on the farm because now there's an opportunity for a salary on a farm. So then we deal with the successional crisis in farms where the average farmer is 60 years old. We need to drop that down to 50 and then down to 40 over time. And so you have this domino effect. And so sometimes I think there are so many things that we could do that we become paralyzed to do anything because there are so many things to do. And I think sometimes if we back off and just say, what's one thing we can do? Yes, let's not worry about all those things right now. What's one thing we can do and just focus on that? I think a lot of times we have threads that go out throughout the fabric of society that we can't even imagine, but we've been successful because we laser focused on one thing and said, let's concentrate right here.
It's funny because the push that I've been doing for several years now is the firefighter work week. It was 56 hours a week. This recruitment crisis, they're working 80 hours a week. And so even though it's not low hanging fruit, it's actually one that took, some courage, some, spending up front to save a lot of money down the road. That was the herd of elephants in the room, as you were. So then once you fix that and they're sleeping well, the weight gain starts to decline, the mental health starts to improve, the relationships get better because mom or dad are actually home when they're supposed to. And then, there's this beautiful kind of vicious circle after that. Going back to what you said with the sugar, I was a camp counselor in America before I even moved here. And I remember the first year I was there, I was kind of friends with another English woman who was the camp nurse. And after dinner, there was all these kids lined up around the infirmary. And so I went in, I was like, hey, what are they all lining up for? She said, oh, it's Ritalin. And I'm like, what's Ritalin? And she said, oh, it's for ADD. And I'm like, well, what's ADD? And I came from England. None of these even, made sense to me. And she told me, what it was. And, a lot of these kids were, from wealthier families. And so they would have a lot of stuff sent to them. And then every evening after dinner, they would have what they call canteen, where I forget what it was, like two or three things every day, sodas, candy bars, et cetera. And, there you are. And you've got, Cisco delivered all the food. They had lemonade or, all the stuff that with their meals. And even though at least those kids were offloading a lot because they were doing, dance classes and coming down to the waterfront where I worked, their fuel was all this processed shit. So I saw it even, you know, apples to apples with this line of children that, I know just needed focus and some exercise and some good nutrition. And instead, they were given a chemical for it.
Yeah, well, this is, you know, this is the whole thing that that RFK Jr. is trying to punch through. I mean, think about the $50 billion in the health research budget, and it's all gone to try to find cures for all these problems. And his whole point is, let's take some of that research money and let's establish why we have these problems. Let's not make Band-Aids. Let's decide why we have these problems. And if we can determine why we have these problems, now you and I, James, you know, we've got our intuition. I mean, you know, for me, we don't need $1 million of research. Hey, listen, here's what I would do if I was king for a day. Here's what I would do. And it comes from a story in California. I was out speaking at a conference in California, and this school district asked me to come out to their farm. It was a middle school program, and they had this 3-acre farm, and they had these two ladies that ran the farm. And every week, the kids had to spend half a day, and they rotated, you know, the classes through half a day at the farm. Well, these ladies, they put in a worm box. And this thing was like, you know, 8 feet long, 3 feet wide, 3 feet deep. It was like a great big, you know, a coffin for Frankenstein, you know, like a great big oversized coffin. And worm bed. Kids love worms. I mean, worms are fascinating. You look in there and I mean, it's just all this, woo, you know, it's all this activity going on. Well, so the teachers, the two farmers said, okay, kids, your assignment for the weekend is on Monday, bring some food. So Monday, the kids come and they bring their Twizzlers and gummy bears and, you know, Hot Pockets and Velveeta squeezable cheese and, you know, all this stuff. And they put it into one end of the worm box. And the two farmers, they put in, you know, an apple and a pork chop and a banana and, you know, a biscuit, a homemade biscuit. And so anyway, a week later, so they put it all in. Week later, the kids come and they're all prepped for this. You know, so they go charging up the hill. They flip open the door of the box. They look in. They pull out the gummy bears, the Twizzlers, you know, the Velveeta squeezable cheese, whatever. They pull this stuff out. They go over to the other end. There's no pork chop. There's no apple. There's no banana. There's nothing. No biscuit. And so the obvious question was, well, what happened? And so the two farm ladies use it as an object lesson to query the kids and say, all right, why would you want to eat something that worms won't even eat? So, James, here's what I would say we need to do for research. Let's go find two or three, you know, young agronomy types, research agronomy types, and let's set up a farm. You know, it wouldn't take more than, I don't know, you know, 5 acres or so, with 200 worm beds. 200 worm beds, and everything that Americans want to put on their soil or in their food gets a 1 week worm trial. So red dye 29, monosodium glutamate, you know, apples, whatever, you put that in there, and the worms have 1 week to decide, you know, do they like it or do they not like it? And everything the worms like gets a green light. Everything the worms don't gets a red light. And we let the worms, because see, the worms don't, they don't get lobbied. They don't watch TV. They don't see advertisements. They don't vote. So they're completely, you know, disparate, you know, unprejudiced, unbiased, onlookers here. And so we let the worms decide what we put on our soil, what we put in our food, let the worms decide, and we become a completely worm-vetted farm food program. It only costs a couple $1 million. And just think, if we did 200 a week in a year, we'd have 10,000 in 2 years, 20,000. Within 3 or 4 years, we could test every single chemical, input thing, whatever, in our whole food and farming system, and we'd get a green light or a red light, and take all the lobbyists, all of K Street, all the whole shoot, you take it all out, and we just let the worms decide.
I love that. It's funny because you're kind of alluding to something that I say a lot, and I'm paraphrasing a quote that someone told me once, but don't wait for science to prove what you already know is true. And it's the same with the fire service. People are like, well, we need to do studies to see if a 42-hour work week is healthier than a 56. And I'm going to take a step back and just think about what you just said, that you need a study that an extra 24 hours is going to make a first responder healthier physically, mentally, relationship-wise. No study is needed. It's common sense. And I think this is the problem is, you know, I've seen this in my profession. People almost deliberately put these roadblocks, these hurdles of, well, I need to see the data on things that we don't, because for millennia, we've seen civilizations eat or move or whatever it is the certain way. Yeah. But then you can flip it around and say, but I do have data on how not to do it, how not to deal with COVID, how not to work first responders, because our graveyards are full of the results.
Right. That is so good. The thing is, it's so simple. It's so simple that it's elegant, and the bureaucracy, the system can't stand simplicity. It's got to take the simple and make it complex. And then oversimplify the complex, you know, to where instead of the soil biota of billions and billions of microorganisms, well, all it needs is nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus. You know, we just dump NPK on, and wow, we got food. And so the system tends to simplify the complex in an arrogant, disrespectful way, and then it comes in and it takes the obvious simple thing, like, you know, intuitively, and makes it unbelievably complex with a million focus groups and big research budgets and agenda-driven science.
You mentioned microbiome. If I want to have a one-hour conversation with my dad, who's a retired veterinary surgeon, I just have to talk about poo, and off he goes. And that's been his passion project for a long time now. He used to do fecal transfers on horses years ago. It's amazing. Wow. Like the animal studies on diabetes and all these things. A lot of people don't realize a lot of the human medicine advances originally came from the veterinary medicine world. Talk to me about your kind of evolution of your understanding of the gut biome, because it seems like whether we're talking about mental health, you know, obesity, I mean, all these different areas, it's becoming more and more evident that the gut health is a big part of this, which obviously is tied directly into what we're talking about, the quality of food that we're getting.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there are more and more studies now, as you know, of numerous diseases, you know, from autism to other things, where the singular commonality in this particular, whatever this malady is, the commonality is there's something that there's a missing critical bacterial. There's a missing being in the microbiome. And so without getting too far in the bacteria, let's just say that all the research is pointing to the healthier, let me back up. The more diversified the microbiome, the healthier it is. The maladies that we're seeing are all all microbiome missing things from the microbiome. There's an interest, a fascinating work being done right now by the Bionutrient Food Association, founded by Dan Kittredge, where they're taking hundreds of beef samples and subjecting them to 150 nutrient analysis. And they've done hundreds of these now. And fascinatingly, there's only one thing that has shown up consistently that affects the nutrition of a beef. It's not breed. It's not climate. It's not organic or inorganic or age, or anything that people tend to market. The only thing that they found that transcends everything else and is consistent is how many different types of plants did the cow eat? That beats whether it's organic or not. That beats how old it is, where it's grown, was it stressed or not, all those things. How many different plants did the animals eat? And so if we take that to the human, not that people are going to eat us, but if we take that idea to us, we realize how simplified the modern diet has become. If you read, for example, Dolly Madison's cookbook from James Madison when he was president back in colonial days, or Martha Washington's, George Washington's wife, they both made cookbooks. And if you read those cookbooks, 80% of the stuff that's in them, we don't even know. They're plants and vegetables and fruits and things, berries that we don't even have. We don't even know. And you begin to realize very quickly how diversified that diet was in the old days. In Australia, the Aborigines ate something like 1,000 different things. Native Americans ate a huge variety of things. Why? Because they ate seasonally and they had their mainstay, bison, but the bison were eating a prairie that was 60 grasses and 100 weeds. And so the bison had this tremendous diversified enzymatic and bacterial option feeding into the microbiome. And so one of the quickest and most efficacious way a person can diversify their own microbiome is to eat animals that have a diversified microbiome, that are on diversified pasture, not just corn and soybeans, but on a very diversified perennial pasture where they're ingesting, 20, 30, 40, 50 different kinds of plants throughout the season. That's the way that we can up our microbiome diversity game faster than actually adding those different components to our actual diet, because sometimes those things are hard to find, hard to get.
Another thing that my dad was just recently talking about, I don't know if you've had this come across your radar as well, was they were seeing a lot of efficacy as far as using diverse herbs when you're cooking. And again, you look at the simplicity of our food, that's not normally a thing. It might be dried herbs maybe, but real homegrown herbs, if you have, someone who maybe doesn't have access to, the kind of food that you run at Polyface, for example, that even that, just growing, some of your own herbs and using that in cooking can help stimulate some of the gut biome that are missing.
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the fastest ways, herbs in the pasture field, we call weeds. Most of the herbs are weeds, but they have healing properties. I mean, dandelion, plantain, mullein plant, wild carrot. I mean, these are all things with medicinal qualities. And fortunately, now there are neat little hanging PVC, like PVC pipes with pockets built in. And you can pack that thing full of compost, hang it on your patio, and you can grow quite an assortment of herbs just on a porch. And that kind of infrastructure is now very available. It's very cheap, and it's created an opportunity to participate in this that we haven't seen for a long time.
You talked about local farmers a little while ago. This is one of the real, travesties, I think, is that there's still all these, mega farms getting all the subsidies. And, what should have come out of COVID when we saw this bottleneck of supply and the understanding that, the hormones and the antibiotics and the pesticides and all these other things are detrimental to the human's ability to resist diseases. I was expecting there to be a big kind of, 180, and now a lot of local farms would be subsidized and would be raised up. But again, that wasn't the case. So what needs to happen? So as you said, we can empower local farms to create, clean vegetables, clean meat, not only from a local economy point of view, inspiring young people to get in agriculture. And we have agricultural schools where I live here in Ocala, Florida, but also so that the local population can get the clean food from you know, 10 miles away rather than 3,000 miles away?
Oh, boy, you've just asked a question that's dear, near and dear to my heart right now, and the one that I'm putting literally all of my whatever argumentative clout on. And so I've called it the Food Emancipation Proclamation. Now, those are strong words, but we have an enslaved food system to an oligarchy. Bernie Sanders is right, to an oligarchy that is a cabal between major industries and the U.S. government. And all food safety regulations are size prejudicial. In other words, it's easier to comply if you're big than if you're small. And so right now, we need a Food Emancipation Proclamation to allow consenting adults freedom of choice to engage in transactions neighbor to neighbor to give their microbiome agency, I'm using all sorts of powerful phrases here, without asking the government's permission. If you want to come to my house and I'm making a bunch of tomato soup and you say, wow, that's great. Could I buy a quart of that, take it home? I can't sell it to you. That's illegal. If I'm making a chicken pot pie and you want to buy a pot pie because you've got guests coming and you don't have time to make extra food for them, I can't sell it to you. There, essentially, we have the entire food system locked down with regulations that preclude small operators from entering the marketplace, from getting a seat at the table. And we desperately need to allow neighbor-to-neighbor transactions. I'm not saying, you know, to sell into Walmart or ship to Sri Lanka or Vietnam or export. No, I'm just saying neighbor-to-neighbor, if you want to come to my house as a voluntary consenting adult, ask around, look around, and make a choice on the fuel for your microbiome, you should be able to do that. We have choice in the bedroom, choice in the bathroom, choice in the womb, but we don't have choice in the kitchen. And if we would allow this kind of transaction to happen, there would be an explosion of entrepreneurial, neighbor-to-neighbor, community-oriented, culinary and direct farm marketing that would, in fact, chip away at the oligarchy way more than a government agency that will be captured by the oligarchies they're supposed to control, which is exactly what's happened over the last 100 years. The pushback, of course, is, well, somebody will get sick. What if somebody gets sick from getting bad food? You know what? Our hospitals are full of people getting sick from government-approved food. So let's experiment. Let's try. Let's give people some freedom to actually make their own food choices. Farmers, the freedom to be able to sell to their neighbors. And let's see where this goes. If everybody gets sick, well, we can stop it. But what if suddenly the price of good food drops 30%, which it definitely would. It would drop 30% because 30% of the cost of local food is trying to squeeze that local food through a size prejudicial regulatory system that doesn't recognize the kinds of cleanliness and innovative processes that, you know, smaller outfits can do. It's a lot easier to keep a kitchen clean that's churning out, you know, 10 gallons of tomato soup a day than turning out 5,000 gallons of tomato soup a day. Scale does matter, and it's just easier to keep things cleaner when the butcher, baker, and candlestick maker are embedded in a community at a neighbor-friendly scale. So there's, you know, I can talk a lot more about this, but essentially I'm concerned that the MAHA movement, a lot of the political clout and equity that the MAHA movement is riding right now will be siphoned off in trading one regulation for another. Well, instead of regulating this, let's regulate that. Or instead of spending money on this, let's spend money on that. And I'm very concerned that we'll end up all quibbling and squabbling over what we're gonna outlaw or subsidize or whatever. And so what I like to do is instead of dealing with the issue from the top down, from a government standpoint, let's simply deal with a freedom issue and create an underground railroad, an actual viable underground railroad, so people who want to exit the current system can exit easily. And if maybe nobody wants to be free. All right. I'm ready to be taught. Okay. Maybe nobody wants to be free, but maybe 30% of us want to be free. And we should be allowed to take charge of our own health destiny and chart a parallel universe through an underground railroad.
Well, as a paramedic, I haven't responded on a single person who's struggling with ever, you know, issue they're struggling with, aside from obviously someone who's had a healthy lifespan and is just dying of old age now. Everyone else, I guarantee you that none of them would turn away a do-over where they could actually live a healthy life. And you see this, you know, whether it's people just carrying a lot of weight, whether it's someone walking around with an oxygen tank and a nasal cannula, whether it's a teenager who's, you know, just been using video games and phones and their spine already looks like a question mark. I mean, this is because, you know, the environment that they've been exposed to has betrayed them ultimately. And I think one of the rhetorics that you hear over and over again is that, oh yeah, but healthy food is expensive. And it, you know, and I want to get your take on this, but from my perspective, it's like, it's not, if you go to the farm, you're going to find it's a lot less expensive than you think. But secondly, that's because all the support is not going to our farmers. It's going to these mega farmers. So kind of talk to me about, because I think that, you know, the revolution that's happening is, you know, they vote with your dollar, as they say, and you're seeing that even in grocery stores and even fast food being forced to kind of at least pretend like their food is slightly healthier. But I think I'm even seeing the kind of the tiny, tiny ray of light of kindness, compassion, and community starting to show its head again. And I'm working on a TV show from a book that I wrote last year that I hope is going to, you know, fertilize that, to use a farming term. But talk to me about how do we really push on that so that we go back to local healthy food being the cheaper alternative of the two as well?
Yeah, well, first of all, I disagree with the cheap food policy. I think any sector of the economy where the goal is cheap will also create a cheating economy. So, now that doesn't mean I'm interested in everybody spending their whole, you know, income on food, but I do think that as a national policy, we worship at the altar of cheap food and we pat ourselves on the back that Americans spend less per capita on food than any other culture in the world. We also spend more per capita on chronic non-infectious disease abatement than any other culture in the world. Perhaps those two are related. But number two, ultra-processed food is not cheap. I was looking the other day, Lunchables. Lunchables are $14 a pound. That's not cheap. You can buy, you can buy a sirloin steak from us, you know, basically at that price. And so ultra processed food actually is fairly expensive. And if you buy whole foods, you know, a squash, a dozen eggs, you know, a pound of ground beef, if you buy that, the whole food, I'm not talking about whole foods, I'm saying whole food item, and use your culinary gadgetry to prepare it, you can actually eat very cheap. Listen, right now today, our chicken here at Polyface is cheaper than boneless skinless breast at Walmart. But you got to get a whole chicken, all right? Oh, yeah, you got to get a whole chicken. Now you're going to have bones and you're going to have broth and you're going to have dark meat and all sorts of the, yeah, you sure are. It's not going to just be skinless, boneless breast. Skinless, boneless breast is a luxury item. It's a convenience luxury item. And so, and you know, you can get chuck roast instead of ribeye steak. And you can get on a pork, you can get ham roast and shoulder rather than tenderloin. I mean, everything has its top and its lower. And if you buy bulk, if you use your kitchen to preserve, prepare, and package the food instead of having it all prepared and pre-prepared, pre-packaged, and pre-preserved, you're going to eat much more nutritionally. It'll taste 10 times better, and you will compete very well on price with other things. And quit spending food money on stuff that's not food. Coca-Cola is not food. You know, Snickers bars are not food. I mean, the price per pound of Snickers bars is more than our boneless, skinless chicken breast, for crying out loud. And how many people buy Snickers bars? So I was in New York several years ago doing some speaking, and I asked my hostess to take me to the green market. So these are the most expensive. This is the most expensive farmers market in the world. We went down to the green market. I said, take me to the most expensive potato in this market. So, I know just who the guy is. So she took me, we wound through the people and went to this guy, and he had this beautiful credenza, basically, of like 20 different varieties of potatoes. There were yellow ones and red ones and blue ones and green ones. So I looked through the most expensive one was a blue Peruvian fingerling potato for $1.90 a pound. Now, that's pretty expensive for a potato. But across the street was a supermarket with an 80-foot alley, an 80-foot aisle, three shelves high of potato chips that were $4 a pound. So let's get it straight. You know, are we actually buying fuel for our bodies, or are we buying convenience and cheating our own bodies with expensive alternatives that are for convenience and don't even feed us value by themselves?
I couldn't agree more. Well, I want to be mindful of your time. I know you've got another, meeting that you have to go to after this. Are there any parting words you want to leave the audience before we close out?
Yeah, my parting words are, we live in a crazy time, and if you made a list of all the stuff that you're angry or frustrated or irritated about, sometimes there's catharsis in making such a list. Okay, so you can make your list. All right, but at the end of the day, take that list, and what's all the opposite of that? And can we begin chipping away personally and corporately at the invert of those things that frustrate us? Because what we really need to devote our attention to, rather than being anti this, angry about this, angry about that, is to create hope and help when society becomes hopeless and helpless.